The content of this program is intended for those who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is John Lucy, and I'm your host for today's episode of Salute a Veteran Every Day, or SAVE, an original program produced in the Triangle Radio Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be talking once again with Kevin Slinkman of Cary about his days as an officer in the U.S. Air Force and another life-threatening episode, this time not in the air, but on the ground. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh, North Carolina, or call them at 919-917-7729 for more information. Visit them at www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out.
Kevin, let's pick up your story now. You're in the Middle East. What happened next?
Well, after we won the war, I came back to Biloxi, Keesler Air Force Base, did a year there, finished that up, and at that point in the time, Uncle Sam decided they didn't need as many air weapons controllers. So I got out, mm-hmm. and I went back to school. I got a master's degree, an MS in information systems at the University of Texas Arlington. That's not too long after that, I started working for Harris Methodist Health Systems. It was an HMO mm-hmm. about halfway between Dallas and Fort Worth. And I met my wife online. And long story short, she ended up moving to Texas.
Where was she from?
She was from here.
From Raleigh.
Raleigh, uh-huh. yes.
All right.
And actually, she's originally from Queens, New York, so which is really bizarre.
What time frame is this?
The mid-90s. She moved to Texas.
Okay.
We got married. Then she turned around and said, I hate Texas. We're moving back.
And what part of Texas?
Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Dallas-Fort Worth,
Arlington,
okay.
Texas, okay. which is about halfway in between.
Okay. Where you had gotten your master's
degree. Right, University of Texas at Arlington.
Mm-hmm.
And so we packed up and moved back to Raleigh, North Carolina. And I had several different jobs working in the IT business. And I worked for 4 or 5 years for the Carolina Hurricanes.
Oh, tell us about them.
Now, it was one of those interesting jobs, mm-hmm. just kind of fell into. And it was a great job. It was the second best job I ever had. And basically, I was their programmer, their analyst type of deal.
What was your first best job?
My first job was the last one I had at the Air Force, was ABCCC. So.
And for our listeners who weren't listening to the first episode, what does that stand for?
Airborne Battlefield Command and Control Center.
And in that role,
I directed A-10s to hit where the targets were and ran surface search and rescue operations. I was involved with that, everything like that.
That was during the Iraq War.
It was the very first one, Desert Storm.
That was in the 90s.
Right.
Early
right.
90s. Okay. So you moved back to Texas, and then you moved to North Carolina.
Right.
And pick it up from there after the hurricanes.
That's right. Basically, I went for an interview with the Carolina Hurricanes, mm-hmm. got the job, and basically kind of invented the job. It was here, Carolina Hurricanes. It was right when they were about to open up their arena in Raleigh. And I was there when they opened up the arena, and I was there the first night. My job there was basically write programs for them to help run the business. I wrote a couple of programs that tracked equipment for the equipment managers. Another program that, for example, if the guy who ran the iStar, which is their souvenir shop, wanted to know how many red sweatshirts they sold in the second period during a game that they're losing, I developed something that they could do that.
So and how would that help in the merchandising?
I don't know. That's what he wanted me to do, so I did.
So you gave them the information they needed. You were the information person. Okay.
So I actually developed it an application that they could run themselves, so if they wanted to do that, they didn't have to. But that's what he wanted to be able to. He wanted to be able to drill down that that small. So other, basic applications like that type of stuff. So help them with some scheduling applications and other things. And I kept running into this. I was there when they first time they went to the Stanley Cup. They lost to Detroit in 5 games. And I think it was the first game here, first Stanley Cup game ever done here, went into triple overtime. So that was pretty exciting. unfortunately, I lost that one. It was probably the turning point of the whole thing. And then not too long after that, they had the lockout. I don't know if you recall that.
Sure do.
And there was a labor dispute between the billionaire owners and the millionaire. And the poor thousandaires down here kind of suffered the consequences. So I basically left that job and found a couple other jobs where I worked as a statistical programmer. And what I did take was companies were doing testing drugs and that type of stuff. And I would clean up their data and get it ready for a statistician to actually figure out whether this drug is good or bad or not type of deal. And I did that for a few years.
For someone who found military academy math and science a little bit, or engineering a little bit difficult.
There's a difference between differential equations and this stuff.
In programming. Okay.
So I did that for a while, and then I got tired of that. I ended up working for a while for a bicycle shop for a long time, and this is probably honestly what saved my life. For a long time, I did triathlons, and I was really involved with that type.
Tell me about that.
The triathlons?
Yeah.
Well, the reason why I started it, I got this crazy idea. I was going to go into the Air Force Combat Controllers. That's their version of SEAL Team. They're special ops guys. And I sent away for the package to learn about them, and the package says you have to pass a physical fitness test. Mm-hmm. And the physical fitness test was a 1,000-meter swim, 65 push-ups, and a bunch of other things. I didn't swim very fast.
Yeah.
And so I started doing triathlons as kind of to help me. It's like short-term goals. I got a triathlon. So I started doing triathlons. Then the realization was that I was never going to go to become a combat controller.
Okay.
But I still did the triathlons. And the way I said it kind of saved my life is it put me in a fairly healthy, robust. I can ride a bike 100 miles. And about 3 years ago, I always did Tour de Cure, which is a bicycle ride to raise money for diabetes research. I've done that forever and ever. And I did one ride. It was an 80-mile ride. That December, I started feeling really bad. I just started slowing up. Recently, kind of quit trying to climb hills. I always find a new route so I wouldn't have to go up a really bad hill.
What was that?
Turns out it was my heart.
Were you having was it hard to breathe or?
Yeah, I felt tired and it got to the point where walking up steps was like climbing Everest. I was really sucking down air. It's like two steps, five breaths.
What was your age about that time?
I was 53.
Okay, early age. So had you had any heart issues before?
Never had any heart issues. I was an air crew member. I don't know how many physicals I've taken, that type of thing. But it just wasn't doing it well. So eventually, I went to the doctors. And the other thing that was happening was my feet were starting to swell. So we started out with my family doctor and says, there's something really wrong here. And they started sending me to all sorts of different specialists, and they started doing all sorts of things, electrocardiograms, everything. They took pictures of my heart, MRIs, and that stuff, and what they finally discovered was I had a bad heart valve, aortic valve.
What did it malformed. How long did it take to get that diagnosis?
With everything and all the procedures and everything, it was probably within 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
Oh, it was not a long time.
Then. No, because they started pumping me through all this stuff. And finally they did a full-blown catheterization. That's basically where they take a probe and stick it up through your leg, up into your heart. And they take all sorts of measurements and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And after the catheterization, my wife and I were sitting in the doctor's office, and he comes in and he asks me, Mr. Slickman, how long have you been feeling like this? And I said, about 2 months or so. And he got in my face. He said, now, don't lie to me. How long have you been feeling like? And said, no, it's only been a couple of months since it's been this bad. And then we kind of started talking back and forth. And then my wife said, are we done now? Can we go home? And he said, he's not going home.
Ooh,
he's going to the hospital now. And one of the test that they take is an EF test, ejection fraction. And basically what that is how much blood is flowing through your heart. Mm-hmm. Anything below 55% is you're sick. I was down to between 11 and 15%, depending on when they took the test. So they put me in Duke Raleigh. I was in Duke Raleigh for a day until a bed opened up at Big Duke over at Durham. And then they were going to life flight me over. I was looking forward to it. It was a helicopter ride. Man, I haven't done that since water survival.
You were made for this, right?
That's right. But they stuck me. Apparently, they don't have a helipad on top of Duke Raleigh, so they stuck me in an ambulance, and I went on over. And I was like, dang. But they took me on over, and it's a great the guys over at Duke and gals, it's a great team over there. And they started explaining to me what it was. And your aortic valve is supposed to have what they call three flappers. If you look at a Mercedes-Benz logo, that's what it's supposed to look like. Well, mine was, if you erase one of those, that's what my heart was. It's a congenital defect that about 2% of the population, male population in the United States has. And like I said, it's DNA. And what happens with it, for whatever reason, they don't really have an idea of why it happens, but this type of valve crystallizes. It gets a lot of calcium on it and doesn't open and close like it should.
Yeah.
And that's why you only get 11%. You got a lot of regurgitation back in the heart. It doesn't open all the way to let everything out. Mm-hmm. It just barely flips open and close. So basically the idea is just go ahead and replace that with a mechanical device or a pig's heart or that type of thing, a sheep's heart. So
the
that
whole
was
heart and not just a valve.
No, this was just the valve part.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay.
So that was the first operation. They were going to replace that. And they did some other things in there. I also had an aneurysm in my aorta, and while they're in there, they'll do a double bypass. So I had a CABG. So that was my first operation. Coming out of that first operation, my heart never stabilized. It wouldn't go back into a normal rhythm or anything. So basically, my heart had gone so long without the proper blood flow that it was starting to die. So the next operation was the make or break one, and it was to basically, they came in and put what they call an LVAD. An LVAD is kind of an artificial heart that they attach to the side of your heart. LVAD stands for left ventricle assist device.
Is that inside the body?
It's inside the body. They opened me back up again. And
this is how many times within a short period of time?
Well, within 6 months, I had three operations.
Okay.
So the second one was they basically open up a hole in the bottom of your left ventricle, which is on the left side of the heart, and slide what they call the LVAD into it, an opening on the LVAD. The LVAD basically looks like a turbocharger off of a car. Mm-hmm. And when Dr. Schroeder first came, we're going to put this one of these things in you, and he dropped it on me. It's like, oh, my God, what car did you steal? Go steal this out.
It was large and looked mechanical?
It was definitely very mechanical looking. Mm-hmm. And the thing about this is to run it, you have to wear batteries. So I always had a pouch with batteries on it, two batteries. And there's what they call a controller, a little computer. And all that controls this device that's inside your chest. So they have to open up a hole, and you have on the side of your abdomen, it's right in here, and where this, what they call the control line goes into. And that controls the RPMs of this thing and also gives it the power. So you're always kind of open. It's like an everyday thing that my wife and sister-in-law and sister all did was clean that wound every single day. For 6 months.
Oh, what a...
And so, yeah, I had to go through all this and survive it. You need a support team.
And certainly had one.
Oh, and it was magnificent. My wife is extremely squeamish about things.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, she somehow controlled all that and did everything, you know?
Thankfully.
Yeah. And my sister-in-law...
What's your wife's name?
Marilyn.
Okay.
And my sister-in-law, Harriet, also came down and took her turns at it to relieve Marilyn. Because when you're going through something like this, I think the people who are tested more than the patient are the support people.
Sure.
So to relieve Marilyn, Harriet would come down. And then later on, my sister came down, too, for several different things.
Now, remind us, what time frame is this?
This was about 18 months or about 2 years ago now.
2 years ago. Okay. All right. But that's not the end of the story.
No. Once you have this LVAD, you get put on the heart transplant list.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, and I was kind of resigned that I was going to live like that for a long time.
But what did you think when they told you that you would have to receive another heart? What went through your mind then?
Every time we went down there, this thing, it was like, okay, we're going to do what I got to do to survive. They're going to do what they have to do to help me survive. And that was the whole point of the whole thing. I was never really scared, except for the night before my second operation, the night before my LVAD, because I knew my back was against the wall. Once that LVAD went put in, and I was lucky enough, I didn't have any really bizarre infections or anything like that, that I was really looking forward to, looking forward to the day I would get my heart. It was just, I didn't realize it was only going to be 6 months.
Did you do you have any feeling about whether your military training and experience and all that you saw and were taught had anything to do with your mindset? That
I think one of the biggest things about being in the military is learning to trust other people. Okay. with certain things. Mm-hmm. When I flew, I trusted my air crew. Trusted, my pilots and navigators that they wouldn't, they would do what they have to do if the airplane got on fire, that type of stuff. I trusted the ground crew, and instead of my pilots, I had to trust my surgeons. Instead of a ground crew, I had to trust the nurses and all the other support team. And this much I got to say, at Duke, everybody from the person comes in and washes your floor all the way up to the top of the line people. They're professionals.
So you had no worries there. You just had to think about what was in front of you.
Yeah, and you have to. And it's like everything. You have to take everything almost hour by hour, day by day. Mm-hmm. And it's like going through basic training or fighting a war or whatever. It's just, whatever's the only thing you kind of think about is what's straight ahead of you. You're aware of everything back in the background, and you understand you may have to come up and face it, and you prepare for that. But the most important thing is now. It's like the movie Apollo 13. Two of the astronauts were going on and on. Well, what about this? What about that? And finally, Jim Lovell says, "Gentlemen, you guys are arguing about steps 1400 and 13." In 1495, we're only on step two. Let's go to step three. So that's the kind of mindset that you kind of have to do. And so that was my mindset, was get through the LVAD and that type of thing. And had some rough nights here and there. So
Kevin, I heard your story when you were kind enough to bring it to our Kiwanis Club here in Raleigh. And I was taken by especially this part where you get onto a list. And what kind of expectations did you have then, and then take us through what resulted after you got on to the first list?
Okay, well, to get on the list, one of the things that they're looking, they have to, other than being, they want to try and make the successful operation. So there's basically a kind of a triage for those who have to get the heart right now, but they also have to be healthy enough to receive the heart. When I got the LVAD, I wasn't healthy enough to receive a heart. And one of the drawbacks I had to wait 6 months for is my God blessed me or cursed me with a lot of antibodies, and they were just going wild at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I had a pretty good immune system, so that they had to wait until those antibodies kind of died down, which took about five and a half months.
Okay.
And then the chief of cardiology, Dr. Patel, calls me out one day. So Kevin, would you like to go on the list now? I said, yeah, let's go on the list. I don't really want this piece of machinery in me the rest of my life. So they put me on the list, and probably within a week I get a call from Dr. Patel and says, Kevin, you won't be primary, you'll be secondary.
Oh, what did you think about that?
I was like, it's a better chance than having being in nowhere, you know?
Okay. Yep.
So basically we went to the hospital. They do that for a couple of reasons. First of all, if there's not a perfect match with a primary, they have somebody else as a secondary.
Sure.
Because you got this vital organ.
And
you can't freeze it. It's six, you have 4 to 6 hours to place it from one body to the other, from when it stops beating in the one body to put in the other. So they have to have a backup, and that's one of their backups. The other thing, too, is it gets you in the mindset of what do I have to do once I go there, and type of deal. How do I go there? You know, I have backpacked all the time and that type of stuff. So you have one practice run of getting there on time and everything. So I got there the first time at 12:30, and about 12:30 in the afternoon, and about 9 o'clock is when everything starts going over there, and it boom, 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 boom. First thing that happens is a bunch of nurses come in and they draw like 24 vials of blood to test your blood to make sure it's perfectly aligned. And the other thing that they asked me, they kept asking me, is like, how tall are you? How tall? Oh, about 6 foot, a little under 6 foot. How tall are you? So that's another thing. The guy who I'm pretty sure I met the person who, or at least saw the person who eventually got that heart, he was about 6 foot two. So I should have said whatever height I need to be.
But they were trying to match everything with recipient.
Yeah, and I think between the two of us, he was the primary, but it also came down to who had the proper sized chest. That's it. So he gets it. And about 9:30, they said, they came back, and, you know, after actually about 8:30 is when they took all the blood. And about 9:30, they came back, said the other recipient has already gone into the operating room. So
your thoughts right then?
Oh, well, we gave it a try.
You were disappointed, obviously.
I was really disappointed, and I was, you know, thinking, it's like, maybe that's my last shot at it.
What about your wife?
Same way, if not more so.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty quiet ride from Durham back to Cary. And probably not about 4 or 5 days later, I got a haircut. I was coming out, and I had all my battery packs and all this other stuff, and I get another call from Dr. Patel again.
What was your thought then?
Oh, my God.
Maybe?
For my first, yeah, maybe this time. And I call, hello, it says, yeah, Mr. Slingman, this is Dr. Patel. Would you like to try this again? Only this time you're primary.
Yes, you said.
Yeah, and I immediately pulled because I was going to this is one of those funny things. I was going to go shopping for my wife's birthday, and ended up turning around, calling her, says got to go, and we again we're back at Duke about 12:30.
But you had a present for her.
Yes, or they are actually Dr. Schroeder and Patel and Milano and all those guys had the present. So we go through the same thing. They pull the same 24 vials of blood.
Do you have any blood left?
It's like, good Lord, people. I mean, 4 days ago, my blood cannot have changed that much in 4 days. So they did that.
But you didn't care at that point.
Yeah, by that point, it's like, let's get it done. And at 9:30, they came for me and rolled me in. And my wife's got pictures all the way down the hall, falling almost all the way into the operating room. And going into an operating room is really kind of bizarre. You go in there and it's cold. They keep it really, really cold. And so they go ahead and they put me on the thing. And I chat up. I first of all, I ask a lot of questions doing this because I'm a quasi-engineer. My dad was an engineer and all this. So I'm asking, what does this do? How does it do it? Why does he do it? And all the way through this, I'm always asking these questions.
You have to be satisfied in your mind.
Yeah. And could be sad. And I'm just curious, you know, how things work.
Sure.
So probably about 9:35, I stopped asking questions because I was gone, you know. And
what's the next thing you remember?
It was 4 days later.
4 days later.
Yeah.
So you were heavily sedated, obviously, through the process.
Oh, yeah.
But then afterwards as well.
Yeah. They basically put you under for 3 or 4 days to let to make sure everything's working right and all that. And they kind of leave you open for a while. And what they do is they put a Saran wrap around that in case if something drastically goes wrong, they don't have to cut through the bones and all that. Because I've been opened up 3 times. This is a lot's gone down there.
That's enough.
When they finally close you up, basically the way the operation works, Dr. Schroeder would come in, he opens you up and gets you all ready. Dr. Milano comes in, pulls out the old heart, puts in the new heart. Schroeder comes back after a golf game or whatever and put you back together again. But that's how at least my operation went. I can't speak for any others, but that's the way that one did.
And your recovery?
It's had its ups and downs. Mm-hmm. Probably the hardest thing about the recovery, there's been, you think everything's going well and then something else happens. I had what they call the cytomegalovirus for a while, which is a stomach virus. It sounds like a Japanese horror monster, you know, Godzilla versus the cytomegalovirus. But I had that for quite a while, and I had to go on intravenous that I would do myself. They put a PICC line in you, which is basically a line that sticks out of your arm, and you hook yourself up to these antiviral stuff. And I was on that for like 6 weeks, which pretty much
And you were home at that point.
Yeah, sure. At that time. So every 4 hours, I would hook myself up.
Wow.
After we went through that, finally got through the CMV.
CMV?
Cytomegalovirus.
Yes.
Okay. And then I had some kidney stones, which were probably generated from the different medications. I have to take 20-some-odd pills a day.
And you did, or you still
I do? Still do.
Still
I will for the rest of my life.
Okay.
So,
small blood pressure.
Yeah. There's something. I have to take tacrolimus, which is an immunosuppressant. And mycophenolic acid, which is another immunosuppressant. And then I have some antivirals I have to take to cover the immunosuppressants and things like that. And then periodically I have to go and get a heart biopsy, which I have to do tomorrow.
Heart biopsy?
What they do is they open up a vein here.
Yeah.
They slide a probe down into your heart and take nips out of your heart. Take three or four nips out. And what they do is they take that back and they see if there's any rejection. My wife calls the heart Bob Newhart. So they have to question to see if Bob Newhart and Kevin are getting along.
Newhart.
Yeah, Kevin, are they getting along? So that's the big thing. Unfortunately, I need to do one tomorrow. After a while, it just gets old, you know, but you get through it. And eventually it'd be about once every 6 months and then once every year type of deal.
But you must feel blessed.
Oh my God! I can't. In every day, I can't tell you. I think about the family, and that's the heart.
I understand.
Periodically, I have not met them. The only thing I know about my donor is that he was 35 years old, and that's about it. It was a male, 35 years old. Mm-hmm. That's all I know.
And from this part of the country. Local?
Yeah, within 4 to 6 hours of that time frame.
Okay.
So it might be South Carolina, it might be, you know, Virginia, it might be North Carolina, something like that.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Please be sure to tune in next time on the second Wednesday of every month at 1:30 p.m. We hope you've enjoyed today's show. I'm John Lucy, your host. The content of this program is intended for those who are blind or print impaired. After its broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.triangleReadingService.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. Today's program is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, in Raleigh. Call them at 919-917-7729 for more information, or visit www.rbrpt.com. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode, please call us at 919-832-5138. You may also reach us via email at info@trrsnc.org.